Philadelphia, Secretary Bryan had drawn an overflow crowd of 16,000 people. The organizers in New York expected a similar crush at the hall. It didn't happen. Only about 2,500 people showed up, leaving about a third of the house empty. Bryan wore a black suit, a black alpaca coat, and his black string tie. At the end of his talk, toasting the audience, he raised a glass of ice water. Booker T. Washington, newly turned 59, got up to speak as well and signed one of Billy Sunday's pledge cards. Another item, this out of Washington, reported President Wilson's unhappiness at the fact that critics continued to take him to task for allowing the film The Klansman by D.W. Griffith to be screened at the White House. It was May now. The screening had taken place on February 18th, with Wilson, his daughters, and members of the cabinet in attendance. Based on the novel The Klansman by Thomas Dixon, which was subtitled An Historical Romance of the Ku Klux Klan, the film described the purported evils of the Reconstruction era and painted the Klan as the heroic savior of newly oppressed white Southerners. The film, or photoplay as it was called, had become a huge hit nationwide, though its critics, in particular the six-year-old National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, decried its content and held protests outside movie theaters, prompting Griffith to give the film a more palatable name, The Birth of a Nation. On Friday, April 30th, the president's personal secretary, Joseph Tumulty, had issued a statement saying, "The president was entirely unaware of the character of the play before it was presented and has at no time expressed his approbation of it." Wilson had agreed to the showing, Tumulty said, as a courtesy extended to an old acquaintance. And, of course, there was the latest news of the war. A German drive against the Russians along the Baltic Sea had gained ground. Back and forth fighting in Champagne and along the Meuse had gained nothing. German troops reinforced their position in the Ypres salient. In Van province, the Turks renewed their attacks against Armenian civilians. Far to the west, Allied forces on the Gallipoli Peninsula were said to have routed the Turks, though this account would shortly be proven inaccurate. There was also a brief report about the bombing of the American ship Cushing. Theodate loathed the war. She saw Germany as wholly at fault, and rejected German attempts to shift blame to Britain. Whatever else could they expect when they have insulted England for years, and she is now simply and honorably keeping her agreement with the Triple Alliance, Theodate wrote, referring to England's intervention in defense of Belgian neutrality. She longed for a crushing Allied victory that would leave Germany blasted beyond recognition. She did not want the United States to get involved, however. The preceding October, she had heard from a spirit medium, an acquaintance, who claimed to have received a message from the beyond. Under no circumstances whatever should the United States participate belligerently in the European conflict. Theodate had forwarded the message to President Wilson. What most caught Theodate's attention in Saturday's Sun was an item at the top of page one about the German embassy's warning. This was the first she had heard of it. The only warning of any kind that she had seen thus far was in the Information for Passengers brochure she had received from Cunard after buying her ticket, which named her fellow first-class travelers and included this notice. Passengers are informed that professional gamblers are reported as frequently crossing on Atlantic steamers and are warned to take precautions accordingly. The Sun cast the German announcement in benign terms, under the headline, "Germany Moves to Stop Tours Abroad." The item included the text of the warning, calling it the first step in a campaign by Germany to head off American travel to Europe during the coming summer. Theodate told Friend about it and said, "That means, of course, that they intend to get us." She was certain, however, that when the Lusitania reached British waters, it would receive an escort. The prospect gave her comfort. Nellie Houston, 31 years old and on her way back to England after nearly a year staying with her aunt and uncle in Chicago, began a long letter to a woman named Ruth, which she planned to continue writing throughout the voyage. It was full of chatty details. She was traveling in second class and noted how crowded it was because of the additional passengers from the Cameronia, so crowded that the breakfast service had been divided into two sittings. She complained that she had been assigned to the first at 7:30 a.m., which meant she would have to get up each morning at 7. She noted as well that the day was surprisingly cold and that she was glad she had brought her heavy coat. A lot of her friends and family knew she was sailing that day on the Lusitania. "My," she wrote, "the mail I got today." The steward who was giving it out was amused. He said it might be my birthday. Friends and relatives had sent her letters and gifts. "I had a pair of silk stockings from Prue, and a piece of silk from Aunt Ruth, and a rose. I had cards from Nellie Casson, Will Hobson, Tom, Edith Class, and a nice letter from Lou, which I'm going to answer." Some were concerned about her voyage. "I'm so surprised to hear that Will and Bee cried. I didn't think it would worry them." She herself hated to cry, but she wrote, "I've felt like doing it quite a lot since I've left." Upon entering international waters, Turner slowed the ship. In the distance, three large vessels materialized from the haze. These were British warships, stationed there to keep the Vaterland and the other German liners locked in New York Harbor. Turner ordered full astern to bring the Lusitania to a complete stop. Two of the three ships were cruisers, HMS Bristol and Essex. The third was the Caronia, a Cunard liner converted to military use and now heavily armed. Turner had once been its captain. The two cruisers lay off the Lusitania's starboard side, the Caronia off the port, each at a distance of about a cable's length, equivalent to a tenth of a nautical mile, or roughly 600 feet. All three warships lowered a small boat, and the sailors in each began rowing toward the Lusitania through swirling mist veils, as Captain James Bissett, the Caronia's master, recalled. The boats carried mail bound for England. "There was scarcely a breeze to ruffle the surface of the ocean," Bissett wrote. "A light mist clung around the ships like a shroud." Bissett spotted Captain Turner on the bridge and Staff Captain Anderson. He knew the two men well. Some years earlier, Bissett had served under both as junior third officer on the Umbria, an older passenger liner. Turner and Anderson stepped out onto the port side wing of the bridge and waved to the officers on the Caronia's bridge. Everyone seemed to know one another, having served under, beside, or over one another through the years. After Turner and Anderson went back inside the bridge, the Lusitania's second officer, Percy Hefford, appeared on the port wing. "He was a special friend of mine," Bissett recalled. Before both joined Cunard, they had served together on an ancient tramp steamer. The thing Hefford had wanted most was to serve aboard the Lusitania. "Now, there he was," Bissett wrote. The two men used their arms to semaphore greetings and goodbyes. "Cheerio! Good luck! Good voyage!" After the boats pulled away to return to their respective ships, Captain Turner gave the order for maximum speed, full ahead. The Lusitania's giant propellers raised a Niagara of water at the stern, and the ship began to move. Turner sounded his foghorn three times, the sailors' farewell. Ordinarily, all the Lusitania's furnaces and boilers would be fully engaged during a crossing, with all four funnels belching smoke. But the war had caused a decline in travel so dramatic that Cunard had been compelled to seek cost reductions wherever it could find them. Turner was under orders issued the preceding November to run the ship using only three of its four boiler rooms for a savings of 1,600 tons of coal per trip. But this also reduced the ship's maximum speed by 16%, from 25 knots to 21, ironic considering the ship's original mandate. Though seemingly a modest reduction, it nonetheless cut the distance the Lusitania could travel each day by 100 nautical miles, adding one full day to a transatlantic crossing. A man aboard one of the warships took a photograph, believed to be the last ever taken of the Lusitania, which showed the ship steaming off into the mist-shrouded Atlantic, smoke pouring from just 3 funnels. Cunard did not publicize the change, and few, if any, passengers knew it had been made. Room 40. Cadence. Intercepted position reports, U-20, Saturday, May 1st, 1915. 2 a.m. in 25D Area 7, 55.21 north latitude, 3.15 east longitude. 4 a.m. in 157A Area 5, 55.39 north, 2.45 east. 6 a.m. in 124A Area 5, 55.51 north, 2.15 east. 8 a.m. in 59A Area 5, 56.15 north, 1.18 east. Reports cease. Part 2. Jump Rope and Caviar. U-20. The Blind Moment. By 8:25 a.m. Sunday, Fair Isle was visible 3 sea miles ahead to starboard, but Schwieger could not yet make out the mainland of the Orkneys Archipelago off the northernmost tip of Scotland, which by now he expected to see off his port side. The mainland was the largest island in the Orkneys and had the highest elevation. On this third day of the cruise, there was new tension in the boat. U-20 was about to leave Bright Hans behind and enter the closely watched waters of the North Atlantic, north of Scotland, in the vicinity of the big British base at Scapa Flow. Schwieger could not have been surprised, therefore, when just after logging his location, he spotted 2 destroyers in the distance, moving with a deliberation that suggested they were on patrol. He ordered a fast dive, climbed down into the conning tower, and closed the hatch behind him. Simple enough in concept, diving was in fact a complex and perilous process that took time and left a U-boat exposed to attack. With a well-trained crew, a submarine of U-20's class could descend from a fully surfaced condition to a level deep enough to clear the hulls of the largest ships in as little as 75 seconds. In a crisis, however, each of those seconds could seem very long. Certain older boats needed from 2.5 minutes to as many as 5. Their crews nicknamed them suicide boats. While diving, a U-boat was at its most vulnerable, subject to ramming by warships and to gunfire from long distances away. Penetration by a single shell would prevent a U-boat from submerging, thus eliminating its one advantage and its sole means of escape. The men controlling U-20's bow and stern hydroplanes, horizontal rudders, now adjusted them for maximum dive, bow planes down, stern planes up. To submerge, a submarine did not simply fill its dive tanks with water and sink. As the boat moved forward under power, water flowed over the planes in the same way that air passes over the wings and flaps of an aircraft, driving the boat below the surface. Seawater would be pumped into the tanks only to the degree necessary to achieve a particular depth. Finding this point took skill, for it varied from day to day, even moment to moment, as sea conditions changed and the weight of the boat steadily declined. The firing of a torpedo made a U-boat suddenly 3,000 pounds lighter. Even the consumption of food diminished the boat's weight by a perceptible amount. The boxes and crates in which food was stored went overboard. The supply of fresh water, a significant source of weight, fell daily. The buoyancy of seawater changed in accord with shifts in temperature and salinity. In the Baltic, boats descended much more readily than in the more heavily salted waters of the North Sea. A submarine passing the mouth of a river might suddenly find itself dropping because of the outrush of fresh water, like an airplane passing through an air pocket. Changes in water temperature due to current and depth also affected buoyancy. A miscalculation could cause catastrophe. A submarine might bob unexpectedly to the surface within view of a destroyer. Bad weather further complicated things. High waves could prevent the hydroplanes from digging fully into the sea. Commander Paul Koenig recalled one terrifying morning when, after surfacing into a storm, he spotted the smoke plume of a nearby destroyer and ordered an emergency dive. The men in the control room below opened vents to admit water into the tanks at both sides of the bow to reduce buoyancy. The boat stayed on the surface. Koenig watched through one of the tiny windows in the conning tower with increasing anxiety as each new wave lifted the bow into the air. Koenig ordered the hydroplanes tilted to their maximum angles and called for full speed ahead, hoping the acceleration would increase the downward drive of the planes. Still the boat stayed on the surface, rising and falling in the waves. At last the planes dug in and the boat began to descend. But now a new problem presented itself. The boat plummeted downward at an angle so steep that Koenig had to grasp the periscope eyepiece to keep from falling. The manometer, which registered depth, showed a startling rate of descent. Then came an impact. Men were propelled forward, along with everything else in the boat that wasn't bolted in place. There was silence. The face of the manometer cast a reddish light through the control room. One officer broke the tension. "Well, we seem to have arrived," he said. The boat stood at a steep angle, about 36 degrees. The stern oscillated up and down. The engines continued running, raving at intervals in a way that made the whole boat roar from stem to stern, Koenig wrote. The chief engineer was first to grasp what was happening. He ordered full stop. Koenig understood. The submarine's bow was lodged in the seabed, which here, according to his charts, was 31 meters below the surface, about 100 feet. His boat was twice that in length. With the action of the waves, the stern at intervals protruded from the surface, and the propellers spun in open air, stirring a geyser of foam visible a long way off. Koenig feared, expected, that at any moment a shell from the destroyer would come crashing through the hull. Now, with the problem defined, Koenig directed the crew to fill the stern diving tanks and blow water from the bow. Gradually the submarine rose and righted, but stayed safely submerged. Koenig ordered full speed and away. In diving, timing was crucial. As U-20 began its descent, its engineers shut down the diesel engines and engaged the electric. All vents and exhaust ports leading to the exterior of the hull had to be closed and hatches sealed. Once this was done, Schwieger gave the order to begin admitting water to the dive tanks. Air was forced out through valves at the top, and seawater entered through valves below. Suction engines helped draw the water in. To speed the process, Schwieger sent a contingent of men into the bow. Just as U-20 neared its cruising depth, Schwieger ordered air pumped back into the tanks to halt the boat's descent. The crew always knew when this point was reached, because the pumps would engage with an angry growl. In the control room, the helmsmen maintained depth by adjusting the hydroplanes. To ascend to periscope depth, they maneuvered only with the planes, not by filling the dive tanks with air. This allowed more precision and reduced the possibility that the boat might unexpectedly surface. While submerged, a U-boat had to keep moving at all times, held trim and steady by the hydroplanes. The only exception was when a boat was in shallow waters where it could sit on the bottom. In deep seas like the North Atlantic, this was impossible, for the pressures at the seabed would crush a boat's hull. The constant forward motion caused a problem. When the periscope was up, it produced a wake on the surface, a white feather of water visible for miles. As U-20 descended, all activity ceased for a few moments, save for those tasks that made no noise. As always, the crew listened for leaks and monitored internal air pressure. Then came the moment crews found so thrilling, when the boat was fully submerged and moving forward through the sea in a way unlike that of any other vessel, not grinding through waves like surface ships, but gliding like a bird in air. A sightless bird, however. The windows in the conning tower afforded a view only of things near at hand, and in any case were usually covered by steel shutters. Traveling like this required a great deal of confidence, because Schwieger now had no way of knowing what lay ahead. In this day before sonar, a submarine traveled utterly blind, trusting entirely in the accuracy of sea charts. One great fear of all U-boat men was that a half-sunk derelict or an uncharted rock might lie in their path. Shortly after noon on Sunday, Schwieger gave orders to ascend. Now came the blind moment, as commanders called it, that dismayingly long interval just before the periscope broke the surface. Everyone listened carefully for the sounds of ships transmitted through the hull. The rush of water past a prow, the thrum of propellers. There was no other way to tell what lay above. As Schwieger stared through the eyepiece, the water became brighter and more clear. These seconds were, according to one commander, some of the most nerve-wracking that a man can endure. The biggest fear for Schwieger and fellow commanders was that the periscope would emerge within close range of a destroyer, or worse, in the destroyer's path. One U-boat surfaced so close to a ship that the vessel's black hull filled the lens. The commander at first thought he was looking at a particularly dark storm cloud. The instant Schwieger's periscope cleared the surface, he made a fast 360-degree sweep of the surrounding seascape. He saw nothing of concern. Here a U-boat had a significant advantage over surface ships. Schwieger could see the smoke coming from the funnels of steamships at a great distance, but the lookouts aboard those ships had to be much closer to spot him. Schwieger gave the order to bring the submarine fully to the surface. Now, in addition to using the hydroplanes, the crew adjusted the air-water mix in the dive tanks to increase buoyancy. Within U-20, the crew heard a roar as compressed air was blasted into the tanks to force seawater out. Sometimes a commander chose to come all the way up, exposing the boat's deck. At other times, he ran awash, with just the conning tower above the surface, imparting a sensation akin to walking on water. U-20 emerged, but now Schwieger found a situation very different than his initial view through the periscope had led him to expect. The sea ahead was swarming with British patrol vessels, six of them strung in a line between Fair Isle and the northernmost island of the Orkneys, North Ronaldsay, whose lighthouse was familiar to any mariner traversing these waters. And behind him, Schwieger spotted two more destroyers. He had seen these earlier in the day, but believed he had outdistanced them. In his log, he wrote, "They heave in sight again, course towards U-20. One of the patrol boats turns towards us. Lusitania, a Sunday at sea. After his rendezvous with the three British warships, Captain Turner brought the Lusitania to the speed he hoped to maintain throughout the voyage, 21 knots. He set a northeasterly bearing to begin a circle course that would take him across the Atlantic. This being May, when icebergs calved in northern seas, Turner chose the long course, which veered farther south than the route followed in late summer and fall. Assuming all went well, Turner would arrive at the Mersey Bar outside Liverpool Harbor shortly before dawn on Saturday, May 8th. Timing was crucial. Large ships could cross the bar only at high tide. Before the war, this had posed no particular problem. If a captain arrived too early or too late, he could just stop and loiter a while in the Irish Sea. But now that any such pause could prove fatal, captains timed their arrivals to cross the bar without stopping. Throughout Sunday, May 2nd, the ship encountered rain and fog, and seas just turbulent enough to cause seasickness. Many passengers retreated to their rooms, but hardier souls walked the decks, played cards, engaged the ship's typists for their correspondence, and sipped tea in the Veranda Café, a calming, garden-like place with 5 hanging baskets, 6 shrubs in containers, and 40 other plants in boxes around the room. Some passengers read books on sea deck, also called the shelter deck, protected from rain by the underside of the deck above. Passengers could rent deck chairs for $1 per voyage. Another dollar got them a blanket, known in the ship's vernacular as a rug. At 10:30 Sunday morning, church services began for 2 denominations, Church of England in the first-class saloon, Roman Catholic in second. Many passengers slept late, planning to wake at about 11, in time for lunch. Theodate Pope awoke after a difficult night. Her cabin had been noisy, owing to its proximity to the 3 staterooms booked by the Crompton family, who proved to be a boisterous group, as families of 6, including an infant, tend to be. Always prone to insomnia, she found the noise intolerable, and asked the purser, McCubbin, to find her a more suitable stateroom. Changing accommodations while underway could be a tricky business, but McCubbin obliged and placed her in a new stateroom, 3 decks up. Second-class passenger William Uno Merihina, a 26-year-old race car driver from New York traveling to South Africa as a special agent for the General Motors Export Company, got up early and took a dandy saltwater bath. The tubs on board were supplied with heated seawater. Afterward, he dressed and went to breakfast. Plenty of seasickness on board, he noted, in a long day-by-day letter he was writing to his wife Esther. But I feel splendid. Merihina, who, except when traveling, went by the name William Merihina, had been born in Russia, in the Duchy of Finland, which would become independent in 1917, and emigrated to New York in 1893. He had a fascination with speed, and by 1909 was racing cars in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, including one race that lasted 24 hours. He was also one of the first drivers to race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway after it opened in 1909. He survived 2 crashes, one in which his car, a Lozier, rolled over twice but left him unhurt. He also tried his hand at flying and survived a collision at an airfield in Garden City, Long Island, in which another aircraft settled on top of his in midair. Once again, he emerged unscathed. Said his wife, "A braver man never lived." He had chosen the Lusitania because he believed it to be the safest ship. In the rush to board and say goodbye to his wife and their daughter Charlotte, he had not had a chance to open the newspaper he had bought before boarding. It was only when the ship was about 50 miles from New York that he read about the German warning. He wasn't worried. Now and then the ship encountered French and British warships. One French dreadnought turned around and followed, but the Lusitania left it behind. Like other passengers, he was unaware that the liner was traveling at reduced speed with one boiler room closed, despite the obvious visible clue provided by the lack of smoke coming from the fourth funnel. He believed the ship was moving at its top speed of 25 knots, and took pride in the pace. "We have passed quite a few vessels bound both ways," he wrote. "Owing to our great speed, we don't stay in sight of any one ship very long." He was also under the impression the ship was being watched over by British naval forces. "Evidently," he wrote, "we are being carefully convoyed all the way across." That morning, Charles Laureate got up at 8 a.m., called back to consciousness by his steward. He also took a sea bath. Once dressed, he strolled the first-class promenade, stopping to chat with the Hubbards and other acquaintances. He dined with his traveling companion, Lothrop Withington. They took their meals together in the opulent first-class dining room at the center of D-Deck, where some 470 passengers at a time dined at tables arrayed on two levels under a dome frescoed with cherubs, amid palm trees, potted plants, white plaster walls, and fluted Corinthian columns with gilded capitals. Gold leaf seemed to coat every raised surface, from plaster wreaths and vines to balustrade rails. Laureate was sufficiently well known to Cunard officers and crew that on some past voyages he had been allowed to climb up into the crow's nest on the ship's forward wireless mast and stay there throughout the day. This was not, however, something Captain Turner was likely to let him do. Dealing with bloody monkeys on deck was one thing. Having them climbing the wireless masts was another. Laureate knew well the routines of shipboard life, including the daily pools where passengers placed bets on how many miles the ship would travel in a given day. Places in the pool denoted a particular distance and were auctioned by a ship's officer. Passengers based their bets on their sense of how the ship would fare, given the weather and sea conditions likely to prevail over the next 24 hours. The most unpredictable factor was fog, which, if it persisted, would sharply limit a ship's progress, for the only safe way of coping with fog was to cut speed and start blowing the ship's foghorn. The mileage pool and its associated strategizing and arguing, and the cigars and whiskey consumed by those present, invariably helped spark friendships and break down barriers of formal courtesy and convention. On Sunday, the ship's first full day at sea, it traveled 501 miles, according to Laureate's recollection. He found this surprising. He, too, assumed the ship was moving at 25 knots. At that rate, equivalent to about 29 miles an hour, it should have covered 700 miles. The periodic fog accounted for part of this sluggishness, he gauged, but certainly not all. At noon the next day, Laureate and Withington would discover the ship was traveling even more slowly. "At this rate," Laureate told Withington, "we're not going to make Liverpool on time." Laureate retired to his stateroom to examine the Thackeray drawings. He looked them over, mulling what he would ask Lady Ritchie to write, and planning how each drawing would be mounted. For Captain Turner, the voyage thus far was routine, and it was likely to remain so for at least the next 4 days. The weather was peaceful for the most part, and there was little likelihood of encountering a German submarine in mid-ocean. When the ship neared Ireland, however, the danger of attack would grow. While Turner himself expressed little anxiety about submarines, within Cunard there was a growing sense that the threat they posed was becoming more acute. Before each crossing, the company gave Turner confidential advisories and notices about conditions that might affect the voyage. Lately these had included Admiralty memoranda that delineated the growing submarine threat and offered advice on what to do if confronted by a U-boat. Cunard's managers still shared the widely held belief that no U-boat commander would dare sink a passenger liner. At the same time, they had watched as Germany began conducting attacks against other merchant ships without scruple. U-boats now ventured as far as Liverpool. One merchant victim, the Princess Victoria, was torpedoed just off the Mersey Bar. These attacks prompted the Admiralty to issue new advisories to address the danger. Cunard relayed to Turner orders to halt all wireless transmissions from the ship's Marconi room, except when absolutely necessary. Its wireless operators were expressly prohibited from gossiping. Passengers could receive messages, but could not send them. Another Admiralty advisory warned, in italics, "Ships should give prominent headlands a wide berth." The Admiralty issued its most comprehensive set of instructions in February 1915 in a secret memorandum that captains were to store in a place where it can be destroyed at a moment's notice. The document revealed a mixture of naivete and sophistication about the nature of the submarine threat. It called the deck gun of a submarine an inferior weapon, and stated gunfire from most submarines is not dangerous. The instructions also advised that if a vessel got hit with a torpedo, there was no need to worry. There will generally be ample time for the crew to escape in the boats if the latter are kept ready for service. The memorandum evaded entirely the matter of passengers and how they might fare under the same circumstances. But it also embodied a realistic appraisal of the vulnerabilities of U-boats and urged captains to exploit these at every opportunity. If a submarine comes up suddenly close ahead of you with obvious hostile intention, steer straight for her at your utmost speed, altering course as necessary to keep her ahead. In short, the Admiralty was asking merchant captains to transform their ships into offensive weapons and ram their attackers. This was an effective maneuver given the inherent fragility of submarines, as would be proved a month later when the HMS Dreadnought rammed and sank Kapitänleutnant Weddigen's U-29, thereby avenging the dead crews of the Aboukir, the Cressy, and the Hogue. The memorandum recommended that British ships disguise themselves as neutrals whenever possible and fly false colors. It is not in any way dishonorable. Owners and masters will therefore be within their rights if they use every device to mislead the enemy and induce him to confuse British vessels with neutrals. The memorandum also included a strict order, the codified effect of the Aboukir disaster. No ocean-going British merchant vessel is permitted to go to the assistance of a ship which has been torpedoed by a submarine. The Admiralty later claimed that Turner possessed still another advisory, dated April 16th, which reported, "War experience has shown that fast steamers can considerably reduce the chance of successful surprise submarine attack by zigzagging, that is to say, altering the course at short and regular intervals, say in 10 minutes to half an hour." The memo noted that this tactic was used by warships in waters likely to be patrolled by submarines. The Admiralty may have erred, however, in presuming Turner really did have this particular memo among his papers at the time the ship sailed from New York. Cunard's lawyers later would hedge the point with a heroic bit of legal prose in which they stated that while Cunard believed such a notice had been given to the captain, the company had no knowledge of what the delivered memo actually said. Whether such a communique had in fact been delivered to Turner became a matter of debate. The Admiralty's Board of Trade had indeed crafted a statement on zigzagging, but one prominent naval historian asserted that the advisory was not approved by First Lord Churchill until April 25th, and was not actually distributed to captains and shipping companies until May 13th, long after the Lusitania's May 1st departure. Even had this memo been in Turner's possession, it probably would have made little impression. For one thing, the memo did not order captains to zigzag. It merely described the practice. For another, zigzagging at the time was a proposition that merchant captains considered worthy of ridicule and that none was likely to endorse, especially not the master of a grand ocean liner. The idea of subjecting passengers, many of them prominent souls in first class, to the hard and irregular turns of a zigzag course, was beyond contemplation. Now, in open seas, the Lusitania maintained an average speed of 21 knots, 6 knots faster than the maximum speed a U-boat could attain while surfaced, and more than twice what it could achieve while fully submerged. This was also faster than any other civilian ship still in service. On Sunday afternoon, the Lusitania quickly overtook and passed the American liner New York, with the Shakespearean actress Ellen Terry aboard. That Sunday, Dwight Harris, the New Yorker traveling to England to get married, planned what he would do if, in fact, the Lusitania were torpedoed. He wrote, "I took a look around and decided that if anything did happen in the war zone, I would go to the bow if possible." First, however, he planned to grab the custom life belt he had bought at Wanamaker's in New York. Room 40, Queenstown, London. Protecting Orion. The German wireless messages intercepted by Room 40 caused deep anxiety within the Admiralty, but it was not the Lusitania the Admiralty was concerned about. It was the HMS Orion, one of Britain's largest and most powerful battleships, a super dreadnought. The ship had undergone a refitting in Devonport on England's southwest coast and was now ready to sail north to rejoin the Grand Fleet at Scapa Flow. On Sunday, May 2nd, Admiralty Chief of Staff Dummy Oliver sent a note to First Sea Lord Jackie Fisher, in which he recommended that the Orion's departure be postponed. "There will be less moon and less risk every night now that we wait," he wrote. Fisher agreed, and at 1:20 p.m., Oliver sent a telegram to the Commander-in-Chief of the fleet, Admiral Jellicoe, ordering him to hold the Orion in Devonport a while longer. That same afternoon, the Admiralty also urged Jellicoe, "In view of the submarine menace west of the west coast of Ireland, to take precautions to protect lesser ships, such as colliers and tenders." Over the next several days, Oliver would send explicit warnings to two other warships, HMS Gloucester and HMS Duke of Edinburgh, and would direct a third, HMS Jupiter, to take a newly opened route, the so-called North Channel, deemed far safer than alternative paths. The Admiralty had closed the route previously because of German mines, but had declared it clear on April 15th and promptly made it available to Navy ships, but not merchant vessels. The route passed between Scotland and Ireland, through waters bracketed by friendly shores and heavily patrolled by the Royal Navy. Despite the North Channel's safety, Admiral Oliver issued orders to have the Jupiter escorted by destroyers. That Sunday, there was more news of the North Channel. Admiral Richard Webb, head of the Admiralty's Trade Division, which in wartime held dominion over all British merchant shipping, received notice that the new route would now in fact be open to all vessels, merchant and military alike. This meant that civilian freighters and liners sailing to Liverpool could henceforth avoid the western approaches altogether and sail instead over the top of Ireland, then turn right and go south to Liverpool. Admiral Webb did not transmit this new information to Cunard or to the Lusitania. Through much of Sunday, The Admiralty also tracked the progress of the wounded American tanker Gulflight, under tow and escorted by the Navy. At 4:05 that afternoon, the ship was reported making good progress. 2 hours later, it arrived at St. Mary's Island in the Scillies, with its foredeck nearly submerged, its propeller visible at the stern. In Queenstown, Ireland, America's local consul opened a newspaper and read for the first time about the warning the German embassy had published in American newspapers the previous day. The consul was Wesley Frost, now just beginning his second year of service in Queenstown. The town was still a major port, although Cunard's largest liners no longer stopped there, having touched bottom in its harbor once too often. Although Frost knew the Lusitania was at this moment on its way to Liverpool, he felt no particular concern. The reference to the Lusitania was obvious enough, he recalled later, but personally it never entered my mind for a moment that the Germans would actually perpetrate an attack upon her. The culpability of such an act seemed too blatant and raw for an intelligent people to take upon themselves. That same Sunday, well to the south in London, U.S. Ambassador Walter Page, Frost's chief, took a few moments to write a letter to his son Arthur, an editor at the New York Publishing Company that the ambassador and his partner, Frank Doubleday, had founded in 1899. Page was an Anglophile through and through. His dispatches consistently favored Britain and time and again struck President Wilson as being decidedly unneutral. In fact, Wilson had by now lost confidence in Page, though the ambassador did not yet seem to know it. The president had left enough hints, however, often failing to respond to Page's communiques. The presence of Colonel House in London as Wilson's personal emissary should by itself have been evidence enough of Page's diminished influence, but the ambassador still seemed not to grasp just how little Wilson cared for him and the information he supplied. Page wrote often to his son, and now, in his Sunday letter, told him of his concern that America might be drawn into the war. Later, this letter would seem prescient to an uncanny degree. The blowing up of a liner with American passengers may be the prelude, the ambassador wrote. I almost expect such a thing. He added, if a British liner full of Americans be blown up, what will Uncle Sam do? What's going to happen? U-20, a perilous line. At 12:30 p.m. Sunday, finding himself bracketed by patrol boats and destroyers, Schwieger ordered another fast dive. The line of vessels ahead seemed to be an anti-submarine cordon, with Fair Isle at the top and North Ronaldsay in the Orkneys at the bottom. Schwieger suspected the cordon might be a permanent presence in these waters. If so, he wrote in his log, by way of warning other captains, it would not seem advisable to pass this line during the day, especially when visibility is very good. U-20 traveled submerged for the next 4 hours. At 4:30 p.m., Schwieger ascended to periscope depth and immediately spotted a patrol boat off to starboard. He dove back to cruising depth. So much underwater travel was taxing for his crew. The atmosphere grew close and warm. But it was especially taxing for the submarine's batteries. Even moving at a mere 5 knots, a boat of U-20's class could cover a maximum of only 80 nautical miles before the batteries failed. Schwieger kept the boat submerged for another 2.5 hours. He noted in his log that his batteries were making a crackling noise. By this point, U-20 had traveled 50 nautical miles on electric power. At 7 p.m., Schwieger again tried his periscope, and to his relief, saw no imminent threat. Emerged, he wrote, and steered towards the open sea in order to get away from the patrol boats, whose smoke is still visible astern. In an addendum to his log, he noted that if still more destroyers had been posted beyond this Fair Isle Ronaldsay line, thus forcing his boat to stay submerged even longer, our situation could have been critical, as our battery was pretty nearly gone. These were deep waters, too deep for U-20 to hide on the bottom. Had the batteries failed here, Schwieger would have had no choice but to come to the surface and run until his diesel engines succeeded in recharging the system. But destroyers, capable of moving at speeds more than twice U-20's maximum, would have had no difficulty overtaking him and would have begun firing long before. Once safely out to sea and past the northern lip of Scotland, Schwieger set a course that would take him down the west flank of the Outer Hebrides, a bulwark of islands situated off Scotland's northwest coast. His patrol zone off Liverpool was still a 3-day voyage away. The heave of the sea had lessened, producing swells of only 3 feet. Schwieger kept the boat on the surface. At 9:30 p.m., he signed his log to close the 3rd day of his patrol. 3 days out, and he had sunk nothing, had not even fired his deck gun. Later that night, Schwieger was summoned into the shelter atop the conning tower. A lookout had spotted a potential target. In his log, Schwieger described it as a huge neutral steamer, its name lighted. He judged it to be a Danish passenger liner out of Copenhagen, bound for Montreal. To determine this, Schwieger may have relied on his war pilot, a merchant officer named Lantz, who served aboard U-20 to help identify ships. Between Lantz's expertise and an immense book carried aboard every submarine that provided silhouettes and descriptions of nearly all ships afloat, Schwieger could be reasonably certain of the identities of any large vessel that came into view. Though it's clear Schwieger considered the Danish ship a potential target, he made no attempt to attack. The ship was too far ahead and moving too fast. He estimated its speed to be at least 12 knots. An attack on this ship impossible, he wrote in his log. This entry revealed much about Schwieger. It showed that he would have been more than willing to attack if circumstances had been better, even though he recognized the ship was neutral. And not just neutral, but heading away from Britain, and thus unlikely to be carrying any contraband for Germany's enemies. The entry revealed as well that he had no misgivings about torpedoing a liner full of civilians. Lusitania, Halibut. The weather remained gloomy throughout Sunday and into Monday. Rain and wind made the decks cold, and for the 2nd day in a row, passengers inclined to seasickness withdrew to their cabins. Each day, Captain Turner ordered lifeboat and fire drills, and tests of the bulkhead doors between the ship's waterproof compartments. During lifeboat drills at sea, the crew did not actually launch any boats, as they had at the wharf in New York, because to do so while the ship was moving would likely have fatal consequences for anyone in the lifeboat. A ship had to be fully stopped before the crew could lower a boat safely. These daily drills involved only the ship's 2 emergency boats, which were kept swung out at all times in order to be ready should a passenger fall overboard or some other incident arise. These were boats 13 and 14 on opposite sides of the ship. Every morning, a squad of crewmen would gather at whichever boat was on the lee side of the deck, meaning away from the wind. John Lewis, senior third mate, directed the drills. The men stood at attention. At Lewis's command, "Man the boats!" They climbed in, put on their life jackets, and sat in their assigned places. Lewis then dismissed the crew. Lewis also participated in Staff Captain Jock Anderson's daily inspections of the entire ship, which began every morning at 10:30. 4 other men typically went along as well. The ship's senior surgeon, the assistant surgeon, the purser, and the chief steward. They gathered outside the purser's office, or purser's bureau, at the center of B-deck, opposite the ship's two electric elevators, then set off to tour the ship. They checked a sample of cabins and the ship's dining rooms, lounges, lavatories, boilers, and passages from A-deck to steerage to see that everything was clean and in order, Lewis said. They paid particular attention to whether any portholes, airports, Lewis called them, had been left open, especially in the lower decks. The inspections, drills, and other activities of the crew provided an element of diversion for passengers. Seaman Leslie Morton became something of an attraction aboard ship because of his skill at tying complex knots. I remember putting an eye splice in an 8-stranded wire hawser on the foredeck, with a crowd of admiring passengers watching me, which called forth all my latent histrionic abilities, Morton wrote. The performance, at least according to his own recollection, drew oohs and ahs and gasps. No one aboard knew as yet about the May 1st torpedoing of the American oil tanker Gulflight, or that in Washington the incident had sparked concern as to the safety of the Lusitania itself. The attack, coming as it did on the same day as publication of Germany's advisory against travel through the war zone, suggested that the warning was more than mere bluff. The Washington Times, without identifying sources, stated, "The liner Lusitania, with several hundred prominent Americans on board, is steaming toward England despite anonymous warnings to individual passengers and a formally signed warning published in the advertising columns of American newspapers. Warnings which, in view of late developments in the sea war zone, it is beginning to be feared may prove far from empty." The article noted further that hundreds of Americans are holding their breaths lest relatives on board such vessels go down. It reported that federal officials were perplexed about Germany's intentions. One question seemed to be on everyone's mind. What is the German government driving at? Is it bent on incurring war with the United States? No one had any doubts that the Gulflight incident would be resolved through diplomacy, the article said. But what is worrying everybody is the accumulation of evidence that Germany is either looking for trouble with the United States, or that her authorities are reckless of the possibilities of incurring trouble. As the Lusitania steamed on, the usual shipboard tedium began to set in, and meals became increasingly important. In these first days of the voyage, passengers adapted themselves to their assigned table mates. For Charles Laureate, this was simple. His friend Withington was his dining companion. For Liverpool Police Detective Pierpoint, it was even simpler. He dined alone. Unaccompanied travelers, however, faced the potential of being seated among tiresome souls with whom they had nothing in common. Invariably one encountered charmers and boors, sheep and braggarts. One young woman found herself seated beside a very dyspeptic sort of fellow. Sparks flew or got damped. Romances got kindled. But the food was always good and plentiful, even in third class, where blue marrowfat peas were a staple, as were Wiltshire cheeses and tinned pears, peaches, apricots, and pineapples. In first class, the food was beyond good. Lavish. First-class passengers were offered soups, hors d'oeuvres, and a multitude of entrees at each meal. On one voyage, the menu for a single dinner included halibut in a sauce Orléans, mignon de sole souché, and broiled sea bass choron, a sauce of white wine, shallots, tarragon, tomato paste, and eggs. Veal cutlets, tornados of beef bordelaise, baked Virginia ham, saddle of mutton, roast teal duck, celery-fed duckling, roast guinea chicken, sirloin and ribs of beef, and five desserts, a Tyrolean soufflé, chocolate cake, apple tart, Bavaroise au citron, and ice cream, two kinds, strawberry and Neapolitan. There were so many items on the menu that Cunard felt obliged to